At 5 o'clock on Sunday morning, May the 9th, our artillery shelled the German trenches and we advanced under fire. We had to jump over two rows of trenches and we went forward with shrapnel and Jack Johnsons bursting all around us. But the Northamptons went forward like one man. How I got through, alive, God only knows, as chaps were falling on either side of me, for we were running across open ground with machine guns and rifle fire coming at us and shells shrieking all around. Eventually, we reached a dike about 50 or 60 yards from the German trenches and we dropped in it. There were about 50 of us in the dike and there we stopped until nearly 9 at night, lying in one position and up to our necks in water, afraid to move or the Germans would have had us. We crept out at night and went back to our own trenches. If we hadn't shifted when we did, the Germans would have surrounded us and we would all have been killed. I had the captain of our company by the side of me, with a horrible wound in his back. How he lay there for about 15 hours up to his neck in water, I don't know, as I was absolutely beat and I had no wound. He kept giving his orders, although he must have lost a terrible lot of blood, and if ever a man was brave, he was. Our regiment suffered terribly, but I can't say how many, as that is not allowed. You must look in the casualty lists, but the Steelbacks did their duty bravely. You will hear more of that from the papers. It was hell upon earth. Those words were written in a letter from a Private H. Thompson of A Company, 1st North Ants, after the battle on May the 9th, 1915, that was become known as the Battle of Auber's Ridge. And it's that battle that I want to talk about this week in this podcast that I, Terry Wenham, call Tales from the Battlefields, because this week will be the 108th anniversary of that one day terrible battle, which achieved absolutely nothing but saw so many soldiers from my hometown of Northampton cut down and killed or seriously wounded. There was another man in the same regiment, 1st Northamptons, Private W. Clayton from Rushton, and he said last Sunday we had to charge the Germans about 500 yards away. Our artillery started to shell them about 4 a.m. and we had to put wool in our ears to save ourselves from going deaf. After about 45 minutes, we had the order to go over the top. We were met with such a fire that chaps fell all around us before we'd gone 10 yards. We had the order to retire and we had to crawl back over the dead as best we could. After we got back, their artillery started to shell us and the shells dropped along our trench. We lost about half our men. Do not think we were defeated, but we had an impossible task. By being so strong against us, the Germans were weak in other places and were pushed back. That's probably a bit of propaganda at the end there that Private Clayton has written, because in the accounts that I read, there's no evidence of the Germans being pushed back any further than their second line of defences. Now, when we talk about these great battles on the Western Front in World War I in this podcast, I always say that this isn't going to be a history lesson. I'm not going to talk about the detailed plans or what happened from a military point of view. This is a story to be told by the men, about the men that served there and those that survived. And we tell the story through their eyes. But of course, we have to look at a summary of what happened during the Battle of Auber's Ridge to understand what happened to those men. And I want to do it through the eyes of the 1st and 2nd Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment. And their experience was typical of the other regiments, the other battalions and divisions that went in to battle on that day, the 9th of May 1915. And the first thing to say is when we talk about Auber's Ridge, it's not really a ridge at all. It's barely 20 metres in height above sea level. But all around there, you got flat waterlogged ground in 1915. And the ground was crisscrossed by deep drainage ditches and so many dikes. And just being 20 metres above sea level was a huge advantage to the German defenders. They overlooked the villages of Neuchâtel, Festubert, and all of the British opposing lines. And the Germans had been here since the autumn of 1914 during the race to the sea, and they chose the most favourable positions and utilised the higher ground whenever there was any higher ground, no matter how high or how low that ground was. And that's exactly what they'd done here at Auber's Ridge. And the other thing to note about this battle was that it was a supporting an attack. And we were supporting the French that were attacking further south and trying to seize the heights at Vimy Ridge. And the idea was that the British assault at Olbers would go in on the same day that the French attacked, but just after the main attack. It was almost a diversionary or a supporting attack, I suppose. Now, one of the key elements of any attack in any part in history is to surprise your enemy. And the British and the French troops, they thought that they had assembled in secret. But you can't really conceal the movement of tens of thousands of men without anyone noticing. And the Germans had indeed seen what had been going on. Don't forget, they were holding the higher ground. And on the day before the battle, the Germans held up a notice in their trenches in front of the British. And it was meant to rattle the British that were about 100 yards away in their front line. And the notice said, attack postponed until tomorrow. And indeed it had been postponed for one extra day. It was supposed to take place on the 8th of May. And from this, the British realised that the enemy was ready and waiting. The British retaliated by firing at the notice and reducing it to matchwood. But of course the message had got home. And one of the problems that the British had, the Allies had, was their guns. They didn't have enough guns and they didn't have enough ammunition. They'd been fighting the second battle of Ypres just a few weeks earlier, and it had depleted their reserve stocks to a really alarming level. There were not enough guns and there was certainly not enough shells to cut the wire and batter the German line across the length of the battlefield. Now, in the 5 or 6 months that the Germans had been on the high ground here, the British had not been fully aware of the work that the Germans had been doing to improve their defences. They couldn't build trenches downwards because the ground was too soft. The water table was too high and that would have been impossible. So they built what they call breastworks. And a breastwork is a trench that goes up using sandbags and other equipment. And what the Germans had done here, the parapets of the trenches had been built up even further and widened. They were 7 feet high and as much as 15, even 20 feet across. The Germans had used lots of labour throughout March and April, hundreds of working parties from troops that were supposed to be at rest, and they'd shifted tons of earth to fill these sandbags that were made up the new defences. And between the parapets and the visible belts of wire, the evacuations they'd left behind were filled with sunken barbed wire, closed coil and extremely lethal. These man traps that the Germans had laid, they were invisible to the British observers from the air and they were almost indestructible. The trench defences, these had been constructed with skill and forethought by the Germans. They'd planned all this. This wasn't an accident. And every few yards in these extended trenches, the Germans put large wooden boxes and these had been buried deep into a thick wall of sandbags and each one was large enough to shelter two men and calculated to protect them from direct hits from all but the heaviest of the high explosive shells. And of course, as we know, the British didn't have many of those. The Germans had placed machine gun posts. They were placed every 20 yards, carefully positioned at corners and traverses to increase the field of fire. And the British couldn't see them. These were completely invisible from the British lines. And that meant that when those lads from Northampton and other county towns went over the top, they were going to be enfiladed or fired at from the side as they made their way across no man's land. So when the British bombardment of these strong German defences started, they still found these German lines a tough nut to crack. Many of the British guns were old and also inaccurate, and they were suffering from wear and tear. Their shells failed to reach their targets in the enemy line, and even if they did, they were too small to make much of an impression. And add to the problems that they had, much of this ammunition was faulty. It didn't go off, and it's still there to this day on the battlefield. So once again, to see what happened, we turn to a book written by the famous author Lynn MacDonald. And she wrote this book, 1915, The Death of Innocence. And it's packed full of individual accounts of what happened, not just at Olbers Ridge, but in the other battles throughout 1915. And there was a gunner, C.B. Burrows. He said the attack starts at 5 a.m. Our section fire for about an hour and blow all the wire entanglements to blazes. They then lift their fire further on and the infantry go over. Enemy reply with intense fire. I heard that our infantry were doing well and that some prisoners had been taken by the 2nd Lincolns, and that in parts they've reached the enemy's second line. The fighting lasts all day. The infantry do not seem to make much headway. Now they have plenty of casualties. Our section is very lucky up to now. Only 2 gunners have been wounded out of 8. The German artillery could not have spotted them yet, I heard that our captain is wounded in two places, but he still carries on. So that account from Burroughs, it shows that at first there was lots of optimism. They thought that the attack was going well. They thought the guns had done their job. They thought that the Lincolns had reached the second line and had taken prisoners. Unfortunately, all of this was to be misplaced enthusiasm and optimism. So as I said earlier, let's now look at what happened to the two Northampton battalions that went into battle that day. And the first Northamptons, their mood was upbeat. There was a private C.G. Freyer, and he was in A Company, and he wrote afterwards, "Everyone was cheerful and pleased that had been chosen for the post of honour, the first line of attack. When he found out that the attack had been delayed, he said there was slight disappointment, which soon cleared off when the men realised that it was only one more day to wait. The positive mood was confirmed by the regimental history. It states that one officer said the attack was going to work wonders. And on the evening of the 8th of May, the men left the billets in good spirits and they were reciting popular songs. But when they reached their positions in the front line, they started to hear the German bullets whizzing overhead and the singing soon stopped. The enemy was just 300 yards away. The first Northamptons, they relieved the Black Watch and they started their preparations for the attack in the morning. At 2 o'clock, the men were allowed a short rest, but 2 hours later, they were back up again. Each man was given a biscuit for breakfast, and for many of those men, of course, it would be their last meal. The scene on the battlefield on that morning of the 9th was a calm one, as the men were greeted by sunrise. It was a tranquil scene, and one soldier wrote, "As if there was no such thing as war in the world." Of course, that scene would be soon to change in the next few hours. Then at 5 a.m, dawn broke, and the Allied bombardment commenced, directing its fire, as we know, on the German wire. One machine gunner wrote in the Northampton Independent newspaper, "The racket was appalling, and the earth under our feet trembled and rocked as though Mother Earth had got violent pains under her pinny." And as we said just now, what also confused the men was that they noticed that the German line was constantly firing back at them during the British bombardment. And at 5:40, 40 minutes after the bombardment began, the men of B and D companies of the 1st Northamptons, they climbed their ladders and they entered into no man's land with A and C companies behind them in support. And before long, they found out that the artillery had failed to cause much damage to the German defences as they made their way across, well, at least 300 yards of no man's land. The regimental history commented, "What followed was less a battle and more of a massacre." As was to happen so many times during the first 2 years of World War I, the Germans were well prepared and organised. They knew this was about to happen, of course, didn't they? We know that from the sign they put up the day before. They rushed to their guns in the front line and they fired a deadly hail of bullets upon those local men from Northampton making their way through no man's land, a flat ground with no cover whatsoever. The Northamptons and other troops, they gunned down in their hundreds. And an eyewitness account was printed in the Northampton Independent on the 29th of May 1915. And it said, "In war theory and practice don't always harmonise. And so the poor cobblers, as we call the North Ants, found themselves hanging on like dim, grim death to that little wide-covered slope. From the top of the trench, the Germans were pouring down lead by the ton from their rifles and carefully posted machine guns. It was more that flesh and blood could stand, and if Northampton had turned and run for their lives there, isn't a man in the army that saw the whole thing who wouldn't have acclaimed them as heroes." But those Northampton lads, they didn't turn and run. They couldn't anyway. They'd have been cut down even as they withdrew, and of course, had they done so, they'd have been in serious trouble with their commanding officers. So at 6 a.m, orders were given to stop the attack and the Northamptons were told to return to their trenches, and that was easier said than done. And it was decided to lie still until nightfall before attempting to retreat back across no man's land. Eventually, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, the sun had begun to set, and this was a tremendous relief to those men that were stranded in the middle of no man's land. These men had been awake and had no rest for 36 hours. They'd been working vigorously the night before, making preparations for the morning's attack, and they'd now spent the last 12 hours in a muddy field, up to their waists, if not higher, in water in the dikes where they were hiding. The Northampton Independent reported a machine gunner that quoted, "Some of the men didn't look quite awake and went past our positions, rubbing their eyes." An unnamed sergeant quoted in the regimental history, "It took us about 2 hours to get back, crawling along ditches, stopping to bandage up wounded, rushing over short open spaces and slithering carefully through the long grass." Private F.S. Whiting of the 1st North Ants said the shellfire was terrific, and after that we had to run through a hail of hundreds of bullets. Another soldier, Private C.F. Wheeler, he described how the German snipers picked off our officers, and those who fell were mostly shot through the head and therefore died instantly. Now that's another reminder that in 1915, the soldiers of the BEF didn't have the steel Brodie helmets. They didn't come into operation until the following year, just in time for the Battle of the Somme. These men were fighting in those peak caps, which gave them absolutely no protection against bullets, shrapnel or anything else. So after just a few hours, the survivors of the 1st Northamptons were back in their original trenches, and the survivors were transported to nearby La Touré for rest and recuperation. Now the 2nd Battalion of the North Ants, they also played a major role in the battle. And at 5:40, 0 hour, numerous whistles began to blow along the battalion front line, and these men climbed their ladders and marched straight into the Germans, who were ready and waiting for them. And many of the 2nd North Ants were volunteers that had just joined up with the regiment, acting as replacements for men that had been killed during the Battle of Neuve Chapelle 2 months earlier. And for many of these new recruits, this would be their first and last experience of war. In a matter of minutes, the whole of A Company was almost annihilated, and B and C Companies, they tried to press on, but they were also incurring heavy casualties. There was a Lieutenant Parker, and he was leading about 30 men of D Company, and he actually managed to reach the German breastworks, but he couldn't get any further because he found that the breastworks and the wire in front of it was impenetrable. And 2 hours later, at 8 a.m, an orders was received from the battalion HQ telling C Company to withdraw from the battle. And orders were also given for the rest of the battalion to retreat, but they didn't receive the communication. And there was a private Lapham, and he bravely volunteered to go into no man's land to inform the battalion officers. And somehow he managed to succeed in contacting the men at the front, and he brought back news to the trenches of the dire situation in the middle of no man's land. With this, the battalion sent a report to the brigade headquarters informing them that no further progress was going to be possible. Their sisters, the sister battalion in the 1st North Ants, the men of the 2nd, were left in no man's land all day praying for nightfall so that they could begin their long, arduous retreat back to what they hoped, of course, would be safety. There was a private Fred Larkman. He lived in Dunster Street in Northampton. He was one of those that was stuck in the middle of no man's land along with his comrades. And he was shot in the elbow, and he wrote this letter from hospital in Halifax to his mum. He said, "I had a bit of luck to get back to our trenches, for I don't quite know how I managed it, as I was about 100 yards away from them and was under heavy fire. I had a river to cross and about 4 rows of trenches, which are about 2 foot deep in water. I had to crawl on my side to get back to safety, but I got there with a struggle." Now, the 2nd Battalion's story ended pretty much as the 1st Battalion did. They waited for nightfall, and then the survivors somehow managed to struggle their way back through the long grass back to their own frontline trenches. The battle had not succeeded at all in any shape or form. The battlefield was now shrouded in darkness, and the stretcher bearers began the task of going out into no man's land and collecting the wounded. But of course, the German snipers are on the prowl. They're watching every movement in no man's land. This was the worst day, the single worst day in the history of the Northamptonshire Regiment so far in the war. The 1st Battalion of the North Ants suffered 560 casualties. The 2nd Battalion suffered 426 casualties, of which 67 men were killed. And a further 157 men from the 2nd Battalion were recorded as missing, and many of those were killed as well. And in total, the British Expeditionary Force on that one day lost over 11,000 men killed, captured or wounded. Just 6 days after the battle, the first mention of the battle appeared in the Northamptonshire Independent. An anonymous letter said, "We went into action about 5 o'clock on Sunday the May the 9th and lost between 600 and 700 of our regiment alone, as far as I can say. It is a wonder I'm alive to tell the tale." And then, of course, the story of who was to blame started. The blame game began. Who was to blame for all this? Well, the Northampton Independent on the 22nd of May, the editor decided that he was going to blame someone. He said that the battalion, the North Ants, was ruthlessly mown down by German machine guns at close range. And he used a headline in bold text. He said, "Men died in heaps upon Ober's Ridge on May the 9th because the field guns were short, and gravely short, of high explosive shells." The newspaper also talked about the German defences being practically intact and the enemy being safely entrenched behind these defences. And the editor of the Northampton Independent, Mr. Holloway, he also disclosed the fact that when these men reached the wire defences, they'd lacked basic tools such as wire cutters. He cited that one of the Northamptonshire battalions had a measly 24 wire cutters between them. So even if the men overcome the German defences, they had no way of forcing their way through the barbed wire. I suppose they thought that the barbed wire would be destroyed. So the Northampton Independent put an appeal out to its readers, and with generosity, they were able to send the battalion hundreds of more wire cutters. It really was a shameful fact that they had to rely at that time in the war on civilians, on people back home, to supply the army with the equipment that they needed. Of course, in this case, it was too late. Now, with the passage of time, we're able to establish exactly how many of those casualties were killed on that one day, the 9th of May 1915, from the two battalions, the two Northamptonshire battalions that went into action that day. And the answer is an incredible 478 men died on the 9th of May, or in the few days that followed it, where they died of wounds that they received in the battle. And incredibly, 451 of them, so nearly all of them, have no known grave, and they're remembered on either the Pluckstraat Memorial to the Missing or the Latore Memorial to the Missing, which is just a couple of miles away from the battlefield where those men fell. So what I wanted to do now was to talk about some of those men that died, the hundreds of men serving in those two Northamptonshire regiments that died, because each one of them has a story to tell. Each one of them had so much to offer the world, as every individual does, and each one of them left behind family and friends that probably never got over the death of their loved ones. And all of these soldiers, of course, have got different skills. And the first one that I wanted to look at is a second lieutenant, Edward Mason. And he'd only just been transferred from the 3rd Northamptonshire Battalion to the 2nd. And he was one of those that died on the 9th of May, aged 36 years old. And tragically, he was the only son of his parents who lived in West Kensington in London. And the Northampton newspapers, and we discovered that he was a musician, a professional musician, before joining up. And he was reckoned to be the first London musician to be killed in action. He joined the Universities and Public Schools Battalion in September of 1914, and he quickly received his commission in February 1915 and went to France at the end of March when he joined the Northamptonshires. His father received a letter that was sent from one of his fellow officers, and it simply states he was killed gallantly, leading his men into the attack on the 9th of May against the German trenches. And he's one of those that has no known grave. He's remembered on the Pluckstraat Memorial to the Missing. There was another second lieutenant, this time a William Palmer. And although he was from Northampton, he was serving with the 3rd Monmouthshire Battalion. And he came from a place called Dallington in Northampton. He was educated at Uppingham School, and he passed 3 examinations for the Auctioneers Institute. And he served his apprenticeship with a firm called Pierce and Thorpe, who were auctioneers in Northampton, and he was with them for 7 years. And it says that during that time, he made himself very popular, both in the town and district. He obtained an appointment last year with an important firm of auctioneers in Shrewsbury, but he gave up that job to sign up to enlist with the army, and he was given a commission. He came to Northampton when his regiment was billeted here, and he went to the front on the 13th of February, 3 months before he died, at the age of 25. So that's another man that had a whole career ahead of him, working as a professional man, as an auctioneer, he gave up that. He went to do his duty. He went to lead men. And he's one of those that's died on those flat fields of Ober's Ridge. Second Lieutenant D.W. Ryan with the 2nd North Ants, David Whitmore Ryan, another one that died on the 9th, and another one that was an only child of his parents who lived in South Kensington, who was 20 years old. And he'd also been educated at a private school, this time Oakham. And he received his commission in August of 1914. And one of his comrades wrote to his parents and said, "Your son was killed at the head of his men within 20 yards of the German trenches. They knew him well and liked him well, and they followed his magnificent lead." One of those that had a remarkable escape from being killed was a Captain Sir Frederick Robinson. And the newspaper tells us that early in the morning, Sir Frederick and several others were lifted bodily by the exploding of a shell and were flung back into the trench. In being thrown backwards, Captain Robinson fell onto the point of a bayonet which entered his thigh, and he's now in hospital in Liverpool. It's often said, of course, that soldiers going into battle have premonitions of their own death, and perhaps that was the case of Private John Paternal of the 1st North Ants. He was one of three sons that were serving in the army of Mrs. Paternal from Wellingborough. And on the 7th of May, just 2 days before the battle, he wrote to his mother stating that he and his brother Sidney were going into the big battle on May the 8th. Of course, they thought it was May the 8th, but it was postponed for 24 hours. And he bid her goodbye. He was 33 years of age and had been through the Boer War. And at the outbreak of the war, he'd been called from the reserve and had been through the Battle of the Aisne in 1914, which he'd escaped without injury. And Mrs. Paternal, she received the news from a Private Tompkins, who was a member of the same company. And he said that, of course, her son was very much liked by his comrades and he died like a hero. And already by this time, another one of her sons had been taken prisoner of war in Germany. Now, that soldier that was captured by the Germans, he returned to the family. But the third brother, he was also serving with the 1st North Ants. And he died in the Battle of the Somme in August 1916, and he's buried in Delville Wood Cemetery. Of course, if we really want to know what it was like, if we can try and understand what it was like, then we need to look at the accounts of the survivors. And there was a Private J. Gross, and he'd been wounded in the battle, and he wrote home to his sister, and he simply said that the battle on Sunday week was worse than hell. Private W. Nunley, he was with the 2nd North Ants, and he came from a town called Rawns, a small town called Rawns in Northamptonshire. And he wrote to his sister and he said, "I arrived here in Leeds on the 12th and I'm getting on fine. Now, it was on Sunday about 8 a.m. when we had the order to charge the German trenches. I'd only got about 100 yards when I fell to the ground, being shot through the left thigh. We were trying also to take a village called Fromel, and I can tell you it was hell. Our boys tried hard to push forward, but they fell like ninepins. I lay out in the open for about 3 hours, expecting every moment to be shot again, when two young men of the RAMC came and picked me up and carried me into our own trench. They fired on us just as we were getting into the trench, but without hitting us. I left the trenches about 12:30, and I think we'd lost half our regiment then." So that young man, maybe in his first attack, goes over. No sooner has he got, 100 yards, he said, and he's shot in the thigh. Imagine what that must have been like, to be shot in the thigh. He's lying there, and then he sees two medical men come up and take him away. But just as they get into the trench, they're fired on by the Germans, who, of course, have got a clear view across no man's land. What could that possibly have been like when we sit here now in the 21st century, thinking back to what those men went through, not just on that day, but on all the other days in the Great War? It's difficult to comprehend, isn't it? No matter how many times I go to the battlefields, I say this every time I go, we walk around those places, we try and imagine what it was like. Even when we see the preserved trenches, it is absolutely impossible to understand what those young men from all nations went through all those years ago. And I think that's probably the fascination of the Great War now, as we try to understand what it was like. And of course, we'll never know that. We'll never know what it was like to be shot in the thigh, be carried back by your mates, and then to be shot at again as you're trying to get out of the way. So I mentioned earlier that most of these men are still missing. Their bodies were never recovered. and they are remembered on the memorials to the missing. 178 of them are remembered on the Plugstreet Memorial, which, although the battle took place in France, is actually just across the border in Belgium. And it stands within the Barks Cemetery extension and is located about 12.5 kilometres south of Ypres town centre. And it's on the N365 road that leads from Ypres down to Messines, or Messines as we know it. And this memorial commemorates 11,347 servicemen of the United Kingdom and the South African forces who died in this sector during the First World War and have no known grave. Originally, they were going to build this memorial in Lille. It was eventually located where it is now, just across the border. And ever since June 1999, the last post has been played on the last Friday of the month at 7 o'clock in the evening by local buglers. So if you're ever in Ypres and you're looking for something to do, go down to this memorial because it's really impressive. There's a couple of cemeteries there to see as well. And it's guarded by two lions. One of them is baring its teeth. And it's a circular structure. So it's quite easy just to wander around there and look at the names, which includes the names of three Victoria Cross winners. There's a sapper, William Hackett, of the 254th Tunnelling Company. And he was awarded the Victoria Cross posthumously after he tried to rescue men that were entombed with him in a mine after an enemy explosion in June 1916 at Givenchy. But he died in the tunnel 4 days later. Then there's a private James Mackenzie of the 2nd Scots Guards. And on the 19th of December 1914, he rescued a severely wounded man under heavy fire. But he was also killed later that day attempting the same act. And the third one that's on the memorial that's got a Victoria Cross is Captain Thomas Price of the 4th Battalion Grenadier Guards for his action on the 11th and the 12th of April. He beat off four counterattacks, he drove off the fifth with a bayonet charge, and he was last seen with only 17 other men and no ammunition leading another bayonet charge. Now there are even more of the Northamptonshire men that are remembered on the Le Torre Memorial to the Missing, which is just a few miles away from where those men fell. And on this beautiful memorial there's over 13,400 British soldiers who were killed in the early stages of the Western Front, from the beginning of October 1914 to the eve of the Battle of Loos in late September 1915, to have no known grave. As you enter the memorial, it takes the form of walls that surround an open rectangular court, and the names of those commemorated are listed on the panels set into the walls of this court and the gallery. And as with other memorials, they're arranged by regiment, Ralph, rank, and then alphabetically. And this memorial was designed by an architect called John Reginald Truelove, and he himself had served as an officer with the London Regiment during the war, and it was unveiled by the British ambassador to France, Lord Tyrrell, on the 22nd of March 1930, so around about 15 or 16 years after most of these men had died. So finally, after all those years, the family had somewhere where they could come and see the name of their loved one on a memorial. As Plumer said when he opened the Menin Gate Memorial, he's no longer missing, he is here. But let's go back and look at some more of those men that died on the 9th of May 1915. And this one is particularly tragic because of the age of the soldier, Private William Henry Snart, 2nd North Ants. Private Snart was the son of Mr. J.H. Snart of Melton Street in Kettering, and he was killed in action on the 9th of May. For 3 years, he was a member of the bell ringers of the parish church in Kettering, and the ringers rang a muffled peal on Saturday evening to remember their deceased comrade's memory. He was a regular attendant at the parish church in Kettering and joined the ringers when he left school. But the tragedy of this boy's story is that he was just 16 years old when he went to the front line. He was in the trenches on his 17th birthday, and he was still 17 when he died during the Battle of Ober's Ridge. Terrible, really. So many of those boy soldiers. A private, J. Hillier, who lived in Farcotton, Northampton. He worked for the Northampton Brewery Company, and he wrote a letter to his brother who lived in Wellingborough, describing how he lost the sight of his right eye through a splinter from a shrapnel shell. And he said in his account, "It wasn't half horrible out there. We went to the trenches on the night of Saturday, May the 8th, and when we got there, we had to dig ourselves in. We had to get over one of our trenches and crawl in the middle of two trenches. Then we had to lay in water till 3:30 in the morning. After that, our artillery started bombarding for an hour, and when they stopped, we had to jump up and rush for the Germans. I shot one and bayoneted one, and then we had to rush back to our trenches because we were not strong enough to hold them. Just as I was getting over the parapet, a piece of shrapnel hit me in the eye. That was at 6:15, and I had to lay there till 2 o'clock on Monday morning, as we couldn't move because there was nothing but shot and shell flying over our heads. They say the Germans can't shoot, but they are hotter than us. I wonder who it was that said the Germans can't shoot. Again, it was probably what these young lads were told during their basic training. Get out there and kill the Hun, you're better soldiers, and then they can't shoot. But of course, as soon as they become in contact with those experienced, those fully trained German soldiers, they realise that the reality is somewhat different to what they'd have been told by their sergeant major on the parade grounds. There's another young soldier called Private Ralph Owen, and he's another one that described the conditions as hell. He was wounded by shrapnel during the charge on the 9th of May and was in hospital. He was 18 years of age, and he wrote a letter to his parents. He said, "We made our first attack at the early hour of 5 o'clock and continued fighting for a time. It was like hell, with shot and shell flying in all directions. Not one of our officers was left, so we had to get back to our trenches as best we could. I've never witnessed a day like it before. We were in a trench up to our necks in water until 9 o'clock at night, and we nearly perished with cold. The sights I have seen make my heart ache. I often recite and sing to help cheer up my pals in the trenches." As I read that, I've suddenly remembered that next week I will be guiding people from Northampton to Ober's Ridge and various other battlefields where the local regiment fought. And of course, those streams are still there. Everything's quiet now at Ober's and around Fromelles. There's nothing happening now apart from farming. The odd car goes past. And of course, we see the cemeteries and the memorials around us. But as I do so, what I think I'm going to do is take these articles with me and read them to my clients that are on the tour with me. And I've also got a picture of young Ralph that was published in the newspaper at the time. I'm going to take that with me, and I'll also upload that to the podcast page of my website, terrystours.co.uk. When you look back at the newspaper accounts at the time, it's incredible the way they describe these battles. Later on in the war, the local newspapers didn't publish letters like this. I suppose it wasn't good for the morale of the people at home. But in 1915, they were publishing them. There's one here that says, "Soldiers' Stories, Nearer Death" is the headline. And they use a word that I wouldn't necessarily use when describing this battle or any other battle. It says, "Mr. W. Steele of Victoria Road in Rushton has received a thrilling letter, it says, from his brother Ted, who is serving with the Steelbacks at the front. The letter said," this is the letter he said was thrilling, "I received your letter today. I can honestly say that I was never nearer death in my life than I was in this last attack. We made a charge on the German trenches on May the 9th, and a braver body of men you could never see. We were mown down like a flash of wind under the machine gun fire of the Germans. How I managed to scrape through, I cannot tell you. The casualty list on the 9th will tell you what men we lost, and the 1st Battalion has suffered great loss of life in the same battle. I quite believe I said my prayers more times that day than ever before in my life. I arrived back in our own trenches without a scratch. After going through what I can call hell on earth for 14 hours, I had another experience. I was sitting in a small dugout in the trench, and three other fellows, Brown, Lewin, in one corner, and Watts and myself against the entrance of the dugout. A German shell came through the top and exploded inside the dugout, killing Brown and Lewin. It blew Private Watts and myself straight into the trench, and after some minutes we came to find we had not a scratch on me." Now, he's used the word thrilling to describe that. I would describe it as absolutely terrifying. And I suppose he can think himself very lucky, him and his mate Watts, that they came through that without a scratch on them. But what must it done for their morale, their mental health, and did they ever recover from that experience on that day? He was, of course, counting his blessings, and with good cause, because I've looked on the Commonwealth War Graves Commission records and his name's not on there. which means that he must have survived the war. One man who definitely never recovered from what he experienced on that day was a Private Walter Reeves, who lived in Farcotton, Northampton. He wrote back to his parents with dreadful news. Although he was alive, he'd been dreadfully injured. "I'm sorry to have to tell you that I was wounded on May the 9th in that big charge. We went into the trenches on Saturday night and made the charge on Sunday morning. I got within 20 yards of the German trenches and then dropped down. Within a minute, my left leg was blown to bits by shrapnel. I crawled halfway back on my chest across the battlefield and dropped into a small trench. I lay there till 6 o'clock at night. Shells were bursting all around me and my pals were being killed on each side of me. I thought I must be shattered every minute. My leg has been taken off just above the knee and I'm glad to say I am going on well." So despite everything that he's encountered there, the trauma of losing half his leg, he really in that letter is saying to his mum and dad, "Don't worry about me, I'll be okay." But I wonder whether he ever was. There can be no doubt in my mind that this battle at Ober's Ridge was badly thought out, poorly planned, and had little chance of success. These young men that were asked to advance across the wide expanse of no man's land were met by experienced and quality soldiers, and they slaughtered them, basically. And it was to be another 3.5 years before Ober's Ridge was taken by the Allies. It didn't fall until October 1918, partly because it fell into a region that was later termed the Forgotten Front. The attention of the Great War on the Western Front turned to places like Ypres and the Somme. But as we walk across that open ground now, as I said earlier, there's nothing much to see there now. When you walk across the battlefields, our minds turn back to those men from my home county town, the town of cobblers and shoes and boots that contributed so much to the war but gave up so much on that spring day all those years ago. Now, there is another reason why I'm personally so interested in what took place at Ober's Ridge, and that's because my own granddad was there, Arthur Wenham. He was a regular soldier that had been in the army since 1908, and on those days in May 1915, he found himself serving with the 1st Siege Battery of the Royal Garrison Artillery, the big guns. And his job was what he called a linesman. I did know my granddad. I was 9 years old when he died, and he talked to me a little bit about what he experienced out there, but he didn't tell me what had happened during the Battle of Ober's Ridge. Perhaps he wanted to keep it under his hat, I don't know. But we have a citation because he was awarded the Distinguished Conduct Medal, the DCM. And his citation reads, "For conspicuous gallantry and ability during the campaign, and notably on the 9th, 15th and 16th at Richebourg, St. Vast. Though continually under fire, he never failed in repairing any breaks in the line and was out under fire both day and night. It was mainly owing to his gallantry and resource that communication with the observing officer was completely maintained." And as you can imagine, I'm extremely proud that I'm his grandson. And as I sit in my office, I've got a picture of him and a replica of his DCM, the original my cousin's got. He keeps it, my older cousin. And I've got a typed up original copy of his citation that I found in his belongings after he died. Obviously, that does mean a lot to me as I think about my granddad, who died in 1973. Now, as we know, so many of those men that died in the battle have no known grave and are remembered on the two memorials of the missing that we discussed earlier. But there is one cemetery where no doubt many of the dead do lie, and that's called Ober's Ridge British Cemetery. There are 700 casualties in this cemetery, and nearly 450 of them are unidentified. They're known unto God. So maybe, possibly, many of those men that are in those unknown graves are the men that died in May 1915. But my closing thought on this subject is that wherever these soldiers are, if they're buried, if they're on the memorials, by listening to this podcast, by talking about them, by reading the various books, we will ensure that their memory is never forgotten. And as for sources for this podcast, well, once again, I turn to Lynn MacDonald, her fantastic 1915 book, The Death of Innocence. And also, I've been using a book by a local author here in Northampton, a young man called Mick S. Mistry. And he recently published a book called Northamptonshire's in the First World War. Now, he self-funded this book, and it is available on Amazon and other retailers. And I know that Mikesh would be very grateful if you've got any interest at all in the Northamptonshire Regiment. He talks about the battles of Neuve-Chapelle, obviously of Aubers Ridge, the Somme. He talks about the various Northamptonshire regiments, how they went out to Gallipoli and Palestine. He covers really the entire war for the history of these Northamptonshire men. And I'm sure that Mikesh would be very grateful if he could spare a few pence to buy his book. But of course, most of the stories that I've read have come from the local Northamptonshire papers at the time. And this is what this podcast is all about, really, because those stories are hidden. They're hidden behind those archives. They're hidden in those archives. They've not been published in any books or websites before. And by listening to this podcast, you're hearing their voices, their words, for the first time since they wrote those letters all those years ago. And my closing thoughts about this battle is it's obvious in hindsight that the British Army at that time wasn't ready to take on the might of the German army. The German army was much bigger, much stronger, had more firepower available to it, and they held the high ground and they weren't going anywhere. Our volunteer army was still in the process of being trained. Some of them had found their way into these regular and territorial units, but we were a long way off being able to take on the German army. And time proves that, because it was to be another 3 years before we managed to shift the Germans from these places on the Western Front. So there's a couple of notices, a couple of other things I wanted to just mention before we sign off this week, and that is the Commonwealth War Graves Commission War Graves Week is fast approaching, and this will be held in the UK and in some countries abroad between the 20th and the 28th of May, when there's going to be lots of local tours, events and other opportunities for people to find out what the Commission does and how it's done. For example, here in Northampton, I'll be guiding two tours on the 20th and the 27th of May to two Commonwealth War Graves Commission plots in Kingsall and Toaster Road Cemetery, when I'll be telling the stories of the men and women that are at rest in those cemeteries. There's a lot of incredible stories to tell. And there's about 100 of these events going on up and down the country. So if you go to the Commission's website, cwgc.org, War Graves Week, you'll find details of all of the events up and down the country that are near where you live. And sticking with the Commission's news, a couple of days ago, the Commission announced that the Loos British Cemetery in France is to be extended. There's going to be hundreds of additional casualties buried there. And that's because they're expecting to find the remains of men from France, Germany and the Commonwealth countries who died in the First World War. And they think that they're going to uncover these because the canal construction project in the area is going to mean that these men are exhumed. And of course, as we know, one of the principles of the Commission is that these men will always be remembered. There's about 100,000 soldiers from the First World War that are still missing. And it'll be really good news if many of these can be found, and you never know, they might be able to identify them with DNA and other resources that are available to them. But even if they're not, they'll be reburied in the Loos British Cemetery's extension with full military honours and with all due respect. So again, if you go to the Commission's website, there's lots of information on there, lots of Q&As on there, and that cemetery will be opening, I think it's in the first quarter of 2024. And the other thing that I just wanted to mention was that a couple of weeks ago I said that I attended the last post ceremony at the Menin Gate. Now, the Menin Gate is now mostly covered in scaffolding as it's being restored, and it's going to be like that for at least 2 years. And a couple of weeks ago they held the last post ceremony up on the ramparts on the grassy area up there, and it didn't really work, to be honest. It was too open to the elements, and also the acoustics didn't work very well. So I was there again this week. The good news is that they've moved the ceremony downstairs, and it's now held on the bridge that goes over the moats that goes around the city, around the ramparts, and it goes past the Menin Gate. It's now held on there, so you can stand at either end of the Menin Gate, not under it because it's inaccessible, and you can listen and watch the ceremony, and the wreaths are laid as they always were, and it's much better. It's much better there. I stood there just below the lions, the famous lions of Ypres, and it really did feel much better than being up on the ramparts. Obviously, it's not as good as being under the gate itself, but we can't have that for the next couple of years, and I think this is the best solution for the time being. I think one problem that they did have, Last Post Association, they were worried about people climbing onto the wall that goes along the road over the bridge. And of course, that's very dangerous, because if you fall off that, you're going to end up in the moat, and that could be the end of you. So if you are going to the ceremony, please do not climb on that wall. They will try and get you down, but obviously if it's during the ceremony, it's difficult to police, and it's not a good idea. Don't stand on that wall and take photos. It's not safe to do so. So that's it for this week. Thanks once again for tuning in to this podcast, Tales of the Battlefield. Still, please keep on reviewing and rating the podcast on Spotify and Apple. That really does help spread the word. And again, I'm off to the battlefields next week. As I mentioned earlier, I'll be visiting the battlefields that the Northamptonshire Regiment served on and taking some people over there to explore those. And when I come back, we'll be recording another podcast. But in the meantime, as usual, I wanted to pay tribute to all of the men from Northampton, from Sussex, and from all the other counties up and down the United Kingdom whose men died and probably have no known grave from the Battle of Ober's Ridge on the 9th of May 1915. And we do that by playing The Last Post.